here we are, and for the very first time. This is exciting. So today, I'm going to talk, nice full house. It's like every chair is filled, but no one's sitting on the steps or anything, or maybe they are. Nice full house. So I'm going to talk today about a case from, what? Okay. I'm going to talk about a case from the Gateless Gate. And that's a compilation of stories, mostly about interactions between old Chinese Zen masters and their students. There's commentary and verses that were added by Mumon. And I relied on two modern-day translations of these. One is Katsuki Sakita from Two Zen Classics, and the other is Robert Aitken, who's a pretty well-known Zen teacher, was a pretty well-known Zen teacher who taught in Hawaii for many years and is really wonderful. So they're interpreting the same case, and sometimes they agree, but a lot of times they disagree. They see it in two different ways, and I think that's really okay because there's really no correct answer or interpretation to a case like this. I think a case is designed to bring you to the edge of not knowing. And it opens you up and it gives you a language for talking about things that don't readily lend themselves to words. So it takes you to a place where you can play. And if you're assigned a case by a teacher, we don't do that too much here, but maybe sometimes, and you go into Dokusan to show the teacher what you've done with the case, the teacher, I think, is probably not looking for any certain answer. What they're looking for is, are you ready to play? Has it brought you to that place of being open, that place of not knowing? And if you have, okay, you play, and you get assigned another case. And if you haven't, you get sent back to your zafu, where you have to try to forget some more of what you supposedly know. So, let's play. I'll read the entire case. It's on your program, if you have a program. The title is, Seizei is Utterly Destitute. Seizei said to Sozan, Seizei is utterly destitute. Will you give him support? Sozan called out, Seizei. Seizei responded, Yes, sir. Sozan said, You have finished 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not moistened your lips. Then we have Mumon's comment. Seizei pretended to retreat. What was his scheme? Sozan had the eye of the Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? And then we have Mumon's verse. Poverty like Han Tan's, mind like cows, with no means of livelihood, he dares to rival the richest. So we're going to go through this and see if we can make some sense out of it. So it begins, Seizei said to Sozan. So who are these guys? This is from Sakita, and he uses the Japanese names. Sozan is the master. He was born in the year 1840. It's Cao Shan in Chinese, forgive my pronunciation. So Sozan and his master, Tozan, started Soto Zen, our tradition, and the two names were combined, So from Sozan and To from Tozan, Soto Zen. So Seizei is the student, and it's Qing Shui in Chinese. And there isn't much known about him, but both of these guys, Aitken and Sakita, agree that he must be a pretty accomplished student because his question is a really good one. So, Seizei said to Sozan, Seizei is utterly destitute. So, Sakita and Aitken disagree on what this means. According to Sakita, being destitute is samadhi. To him, destitute is a really positive thing. What he has lost is his property. That consists of his deluded thoughts, his self-centered ego, things like that. Samadhi is a deep form of concentration. It's a non-dualistic state of consciousness. So he's completely unattached. He's completely aware of the interconnections between all things. He's sort of gotten out of in here, me, Seize, and what I need and want, and he's out there everywhere. Seize is just one part of something really vast. So his vision is not clouded by the needs of the individual self. He's complete in this moment. This is big mind. But in Aitken's view, Seize is not doing so well. Seize is experiencing the dark night of the soul, as he calls it, which is a kind of spiritual malaise or despair. Aitken says what David the psalmist called the valley of the shadow of death, and William James called the sick soul. But Aitken says this is actually a very promising condition. It's an essential phase of spiritual evolution. It often precedes a breakthrough, some kind of total despair. Perhaps you've experienced something like that. So according to Aitken, Seize really is hurting. He really does need alms. He genuinely wants help. He's not fully realized yet. He feels he is not complete in this moment. So he is in that world of self where his own needs are calling the shots. This is small mind. And he says, will you give him support? Meaning, will you give me support? Aitken says it this way, please give me alms. So this is an expression of need. He's asking the teacher for something. And why is he doing this? And again, the two teachers disagree. Sakita has said that he's in complete samadhi. So why would he ask for alms? If you're in complete samadhi, you don't need anything. Well, Sakita thinks he's kind of laying a trap for the teacher here. He's testing the master. He's challenging him to Dharma combat, which is a sort of a debate between two enlightened people. Well, why would Seize do that? We could say he's coming from a place of ego, that he simply wants to be the best, but I think that would be inconsistent with being in samadhi. So I think, and Sakita thinks, that he's coming from a place of non-ego, of non-self. He's acting competitively, it's true, but he's doing it simply to arrive at the truth. If we tussle in this way, we will come to what is really going on here. So under Sakita's view, Seize probably knows the type of answer he's looking for. You know, I'm going to see if this guy's any good. I'm going to see if he can be my teacher. So Aitken, who believes that Seize is experiencing the dark night of the soul, believes that Seize really is making a genuine request for help. This means that he's coming from that place of need. But to complicate it a little bit, Aitken also believes that Seize is to some extent testing Sozan. Not to best him, but he examines the teacher as his own practice. He knows he needs help, but he needs to ascertain if this teacher is any good. And he asks a brilliant question. I don't think he knows the answer under this view, but he thinks the teacher may reveal something of himself in answering. So the question is, will Sozan rise to the occasion? What's going to happen next? So Sozan called out, Seize! Seize responded, yes, sir. Well, that doesn't sound like much. That sounds maybe pretty mundane. But it's a lot. It's only 8 words. And yet it is so rich. How is it that Sozan rises to the occasion? He doesn't answer the question right away, as you might expect. Instead, he just calls Seize's name. Seize! He doesn't whisper it. He calls it. He shouts. Hey, you, here, now, right now, you. So Seize responds, and I think we can assume that he does this immediately, with yes. Yes, that is impressive because it's immediate. Seize is right here in the world. No hesitancy. No self in the way. Whether he's hurting or not, he's right here. He's a student of some accomplishment. Sakita calls this exchange an exercise in positive samadhi, calling and responding, the answer coming like an echo to the call. Aitken calls it a splendid presentation. And note that Seize says, yes, sir. Why does he throw the sir in there? Is it a sign of respect for the Zen teacher? Maybe. But there may be something else, and I'll talk about that later. So, Sozan said, "You have finished 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say that you have not moistened your lips." So I think that's a good answer. He may be saying that by responding just now with "yes, sir," you came completely to the moment, and that was perfect, and that was all you needed. You have all you need, and yet you say you are lacking. You are not lacking. Look what you just did. And this is the essential Zen medicine. This is what the Zen teacher does. The student comes in and says, "This or that is not right." And the teacher says, "Hey, you, wake up right here, right now." And the teacher may do something dramatic. Here it's just a call and a response that cuts through the student's personal drama. And this says, you may feel that you're in need right now, but you have everything you need. You have everything you could want. The problem is the needing and the wanting. Stop the needing, stop the wanting. Hey, you, it's right here. Lay down the fight. You are okay, and this is okay. The student comes into the teacher and says, "I am so lacking. I don't have what I need. I have this idea that I need something different from what I have. And if I don't have that, I'm just hurting." And the master says, "You need to give up your habit of asking, 'How can this thing I've encountered serve me?' And instead you need to ask, 'How can I truly see this thing that I've encountered?'" Hakuin says in the song in praise of Zazen, "How near the truth, yet how far we seek, like one in water crying, 'I thirst.'" And Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, "Why leave behind the seat in your own home to wander in vain through the dusty realms of other lands?" You don't need to go to India to do this, or China or Japan. You just need to go right over there. You don't have to go over the rainbow. You have what you need right here in Kansas. And Aitken might say, "Your dark night of the soul is exactly what you need. This is fertile ground. The dark night of the soul precedes realization. You must lose everything before you can really let go." So that's the end of the case. And now we have Mumon's comment. And this exchange, the exchange we've just talked about, is open to wide interpretation. Mumon could go many places with this. Let's see where he chooses to go. He says, Seizei pretended to retreat. What was his scheme? Sozan had the eye of the Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? So we begin with Seizei pretended to retreat. Right away we can see that this is consistent with Sakita's view that Seizei doesn't really need alms at all. He's pretending to be in need. He's laying a trap for Sozan. He's kind of playing a power game here. He's pretending to retreat. And I wonder, is that why he called him sir? To throw him off guard? Does he really maybe not need the sir? He wants to see if he can maybe lure Sozan into giving him a bad answer. Something like, you're right, you are no good right now, and you need to become something else. That would show that Sozan is not in the moment and not a very good teacher. And Aitken agrees that it's a challenge, but again, he believes Seizei is challenging Sozan because he genuinely needs help. He says it this way, Seizei was submissive in manner. And then next, what was his scheme? A scheme. So Sakita is making it very clear here. But according to Aitken, it's what is his real intention? Quite different. Sozan had the eye of the Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. Sakita says in his commentary, Sozan was on the defensive, but his was the defense of the master player, which is also attack. Aitken, quite different. Sozan has the eye and thoroughly discerns what Seizei means. Not so much power, not so much manipulation there. Sozan sees samadhi and sees clearly that Seizei has what he needs if he can only wake up to it. In Aitken's version, there is no dharma combat, there is just searching for the truth. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? I think, after spending about a week with these two guys, that this is really the heart of the case, and it just jumps off the page to me. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? There's however, so forget everything I just said before, that doesn't matter. Here's the real thing. I want to ask you, here's Mumon addressing us suddenly. I mean, we were all safe, we're reading this old story, we're fine, and suddenly he's coming after us. At what point did Seizei drink wine? Which is a weird and interesting question. So Aitken likes this line too, and he says, this is the key point. So we have to consider the background against which Mumon posits this question. This case presents two possible ways of being in the world. Sakita picks up on one of them, Aitken picks up on the other. One way is samadhi, complete concentration, being present in the interconnected world, not being dominated by personal needs. The exemplar of that is the Zen master or the Zen student sitting on the zafu with no thought and no personal need, and then carrying this sort of mind with him or her into the world. And the other way is the way of need, coming to the master incomplete, needing to be fixed, not knowing that everything is right here, grasping, reaching. And the exemplar for this would be the Zen teacher or the Zen student driving his car and listening to the radio while texting. So Mumon knows that this story can be interpreted with Seizei being selfless or with Seizei being in need and dominated by the self. And it is against this background that he asks, at what point did Seizei drink wine? We might ask, which Seizei is drinking the wine? But first, what is the wine? Wine is commonly associated with pleasure. What kind of pleasure does it bring? I think that's a key point, and there are two possibilities here. There is the kind of pleasure that fulfills need. This case could have said tea. But it says wine, I think, because it wants to emphasize pleasure in a kind of conventional sense, the fulfillment of desire. We're talking about a base kind of joy here, we could say. At what point did Seizei fulfill his desire, could be the question. The other possibility is that it's a completely different kind of pleasure, that it's the joy of samadhi, that it's not joy in the conventional sense at all. Because if you're in samadhi, there's no one there to feel the joy. It's not, oh, I'm in samadhi, I feel really good. That's not samadhi. By definition, it is not. So why would the case use wine to describe a kind of pleasure that has nothing to do with the fulfillment of desire? Well, it could be because it's hard to explain samadhi to someone who hasn't experienced it. This could be an attempt to describe the absence of desire to the desiring mind. Really, it's nothing like wine, but if we call it wine, the unenlightened will get it and they'll want to pursue it. It's kind of like comparing the Dharma to a jewel. You know, it's really not like a jewel, but a jewel is something we can relate to. Oh, that's something really wonderful and good. So years ago when I lived in Omaha, one day I encountered a sacred tree. I was walking my dog in a park, and I looked at this tree for a little bit, and always thereafter when I went back to it, I thought, that's the sacred tree. It was a white pine, I think, and it had had a large limb, maybe 8 inches across, as I remember, that had been cut off with a chainsaw. And that cut-off place was this flat disc painted with a black substance, and it had begun to heal. There was this brutal scar, and there was the flat round disc, but now the tree bark, the outer layer of the tree, was starting to move in there and heal that circle, and it was going to keep going in kind of an uneven way, and eventually it would cover that scar completely. And that was really beautiful, and I thought that was kind of inspiring, and that was something I could learn from. But that's not the reason it was a sacred tree. And after I visited it again and again, I came to realize that it was sacred because of the way I had seen it that first time. When I saw it that first time, I really saw it. There were no words involved. It was just seeing what was going on there. Somehow my filter, the filter of me, the filter of my views and opinions and needs, was not present when my eyes fell on that tree. How I got into that space, I don't know. But so I realized then that anything in the world is sacred if you can only see it. Anything else I could open up to, that would be sacred space too. I simply call this sacred space because I remember being able to see there. And I felt good about that. I felt good about having really seen that tree. It made me happy when I was there. And I have to ask you, at what point did I feel the joy? Was it that first time when I dropped all the filters and I really saw the tree? I don't know. I didn't feel joy then in a conventional sense because there was no eye to see the tree. It was the absence of eye that created the experience. The tree was sacred because it was viewed by absence of Ted. How can absence of Ted feel joy? Or was it later when Ted returned, needful Ted, that I felt the joy? Was this needful Ted saying, ooh, that was really nice. That makes me feel really good. I'm going to go back and try to get some more of that. So are we talking about simple fulfillment of desire? Or was this joy, and I think this is the key point, something that had to do with the intersection of these two things? The intersection of Ted and absence of Ted. Or was it something about the transition between these two? Was it non-Ted passing into Ted when the joy occurred? Or was it vice versa? Was it neither Ted nor not Ted who felt the joy? Was it both? So our two teachers seem to be comparing fine wine to samadhi. Aitken says, it's the wine of the house of no color and no form. Sakita says, it's the fine wine of samadhi. It is complete, finished in every second, and yet also ever present. But I think comparing the experience of samadhi to drinking wine is just plain strange. Again, I ask, is the joy, the wine, something about the intersection of samadhi and non-samadhi? If you walk out of the zendo and you see the lake and the beauty is so great that you cry, who is crying? Is samadhi crying? Is the needful little man crying? Is the needful man crying as he disappears? Is he crying as he comes back? Or is it because in this moment he's simultaneously appearing and disappearing? Is he both is and isn't at the same time? Or maybe he's laughing. Or maybe he's laughing and crying at the same time. Tell me, who is it that is laughing and crying at the same time? Who is it? Who is it that feels that emotion? At what point did Seizei drink the wine? And so we have that question. And that's the end of the comment. So is there an answer? Well, we still have the verse. Can we look to the verse for an answer? I'm thinking no, because we're not likely to get an answer. But let's see what happens here. Aitken seems to think the question is the whole deal. He says, if you truly appreciate Mumon here, then you, Mumon, Sozan, and Seizei too are all sloshed together. So here's the verse. Poverty like Hantons, mind like cows, with no means of livelihood, he dares to rival the richest. I think he can't really give us the answer. I think posing that question and bringing us to that place of great mystery is enough. Who is it? Or to quote another koan, who is carrying around this lifeless body of yours? But Mumon can tell us what it looks like to be in the world when one lives with this question. When one is constantly open, when one is without fixed views, when one constantly says each moment, who is it? Who is it now? Here's what he says. First, poverty like Han Tan's. Okay, Han Tan was a famous Chinese scholar who was appointed to the post of governor, but he didn't take up his post. Instead, he took his wife and children around in a pushcart, eking out a living as a fortune teller. So he lived in voluntary poverty. He was renowned in China because of his contentment. So I think he's the very model of finding peace through acceptance of how things are in the world. He takes the low road. He's very humble. He's that Zen master or Zen student sitting on the Zafu here in the Zendo. Mind like cows. So Cao was a great Chinese general, renowned for his valor. He won every battle he was ever in, except the last one, in which he was defeated by the founder of the Han Dynasty. So he was surrounded by enemy forces. He sat in his tent, unmoved by the approach of death. He takes the high road. He's courageous. He's assertive. He's active in the world. With no means of livelihood, he dares to rival the richest. So Seizei has poverty like Han Tan. He's willing to live on nothing. He embraces being utterly destitute. He's coming from that place of interconnectedness and no self, and he's humble. And we could imagine him bowing very deeply. We could imagine him doing 108 prostrations, putting all the world above him. But Seizei also has a mind like cows, a mind that embraces courage and action in the world. And we can't so easily imagine him bowing. We imagine him out in the world, coming from a place of wisdom and compassion, but being very strong, very assertive, at the head of his army. So this, apparently, according to Mumon, is the ideal combination, acting strongly in the world while coming from a place of no self. And Aitken writes about these lines and talks about being resolute. He ends up with some regret about his own non-assertiveness in the world. He says that realization sometimes emerges in these Dharma exchanges. Here it's not an effort to overpower another. Seizei finds himself in original poverty. He has nothing at all. What does he do? Well, he doesn't appear and say, I have nothing to show. He does not do that. He says, that's what I did with Yasutani Roshi for more years than I care to remember, weak, spirited, and irresolute. He would go to his teacher and he just didn't have anything. He wasn't standing up in the world. And he now regrets that. He wish he had been there. He wish he had been there. Zen's not always about just sort of yielding and being quiet. He says, if you can see into Mumon's lines and take them into your heart, then your spirit too covers the whole earth. He's talking about standing up. So, and these two things are not inconsistent. Because we see interconnectedness and because we let go of self, because we do those deep prostrations, there is sometimes this misconception that we're passive and we always yield and that is the way of liberation. That's part of it, but it's not true. It is not the whole story because the fully realized person acts assertively in the world, coming from the place of truth rather than of need in order to relieve suffering. And the person who is not fully realized yet imitates that. And eventually that doubt, that hesitancy, that irresoluteness is going to drop away. And that brings me to another question. That's kind of the end of the discussion of this case, but there's another thing I'd like to talk about, and I think it's important. And it's a point about how we teach Zen today. When I say we, I should really say I, because I don't want to impugn the way anyone else teaches Zen. If we can agree that both of these things are essential, action in the world, dharma combat, and also no self, the forceful self and the quiet self, if we can agree that they are both important, and they are, because you have to totally give up the self. You have to be totally quiet. You have to totally yield to really see the truth, but you don't stay like that all the time. You come roaring back and you're here in the world. We might ask whether this is always reflected in our teaching, whether we are adequately reflecting both sides. And I think we all know about no self, and we teach that pretty well, but we tend to de-emphasize the other part about action in the world. And some of it may be our tradition. Most of our tradition was developed in China and Japan, and these were societies where I think the common good was much more emphasized and didn't have that great sense of individuality that we have. Also, Zen training in China was largely for monastics. And here in the U.S., we have our highly individualized culture, and we are not monastics. None of us are, as far as I know. We all live here, here in the busy world where we need to be assertive. So enlightenment and seeking enlightenment are not inconsistent with maintaining a healthy ego. We all do that. Self is there. Even if you let go of self completely and totally for a while, it's going to eventually come it's going to come sneaking back in. It's still going to be there. And it may be even kind of more starkly evident than it was before. It may be reduced. You may have a new kind of relationship with it. But most of us on this path are going to spend most of our time kind of wrestling with this ego that is present and this practice we have of letting that self go. They're going to be interacting all the time. We need to be good at both of these. We can't just say, well, just, you know, forget the ego and you'll be fine. And we're very good at emphasizing no self. Sometimes I think we talk about ego like it was the enemy. We need to emphasize building up the self, meaning this healthy ego, as well. We need to emphasize that. And one person I know really well, I think I've mentioned this before, who was a little older than me, she is a feminist. And she was very aware of the messages she got growing up in an earlier era about how she couldn't do certain things because she was a woman. And she was a little skeptical of Zen. She declined my invitation to practice Zen. And she said, I want to get an ego before I lose my ego. And I thought that was pretty good. She's thinking, well, Zen's not quite right for me. All that bowing and stuff, that's just not where I'm coming from. And I think about how full prostrations may not particularly appeal to someone who has been told in one way or another that they are no good. You know, someone who may have gotten this message as a child, or someone who has experienced discrimination based on race or gender or disability or sexual preference or immigration status or being transgender or any manner of things like that. Prostrations are great, but they got to be paired with standing up, too. You got to stand up. So how do you build up the healthy self in a non-clinging way, and how is that incorporated into our teaching? You know where I think that happens primarily? I was thinking about this. I think it happens in the relationship with a teacher. Those of you who are working with a teacher, you know, why is it that in 400 dokusans I had with my own teacher, I came out of that room feeling better about 375 times? And the other 25s is probably because I wasn't wasn't ready to hear. It's because my teacher has this ability to correct a certain kind of error, and that error is a kind of confusion. The proper message, the appropriate message, is I need to set aside the self now and see how things are interconnected so I can become very, very quiet and I can become strong and I can be able to help all beings. But we have a tendency, because of what we bring to our practice, to confuse that with I must set the self aside because I'm no good. That's confusing because setting aside the self to save all beings come from a place of love. Setting the self aside because I'm no good comes from a place of fear. You need the teacher sometimes to point out that error. When we go inside, we get tangled up with messages we've received. We need a little guidance. But since not everyone works with a teacher, I think we need to incorporate that message into our talks as well. And we do sometimes, of course. Along with the truth of your emptiness, you have to recognize the truth of your self-worth. We cut through the delusion that is your ego, but we also cut through the delusion of your lack of worth. You are beautiful and strong. I know this about you. And I have this picture of one of my Dharma sisters, and I think she's here, and I warned her I would do this because I didn't want to embarrass her. This is my favorite picture of Susan. Susan and I have been friends for like 24 years. I know you can't see it. I'll put it on the bulletin board later. But I love this picture, and I think it was taken at my Shuso ceremony, which is an important ceremony. You know, it's like, it's a big step for me in the path toward becoming a teacher. And it's good for the whole community, and we tend to feel great about that. And the look on her face, it's kind of like, this is so wonderful, we are doing so great. You know, there's kind of a selfless pride here that I really like. And she doesn't know this, but I keep this in at work, I keep this in my cubicle for inspiration. It's a kind of a selfless pride. It's a kind of being in the world in a strong way that I think is really wonderful. So, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there is something deficient in Zen. This path of letting go of the self is the very path that leads to a strong, healthy self. That may sound contradictory, but hey, this is Zen. And we don't have to wait for enlightenment to experience this strong and healthy self. It's part of our path, and we have to pay attention to it. Was Seizei coming from a place of need or not? Either way, he dared to rival the richest. Let's dare to do that. And that's what I have to say. And we have a little time, so I would love to hear a comment or two. Does anyone have anything to say? Yes, I see a hand in the Founders Hall.
I'm wondering if you consider this as you analyze these cases, maybe your day job, or if it's talked about in Zen Buddhist writings, that you cannot see the body language of these interactions. Mm-hmm.
You cannot see the body language of these interactions. That's pretty interesting. I guess we have to kind of make that up. We have to imagine what it's like. But if we were to see it, if someone were to do a new collection of the Gateless Barrier on video, and we could see that, you know, maybe Seizei and Sozan are just really quiet, and we see Seizei's like, you know, you can tell he's really hurting, or maybe they're being really fierce. That's pretty interesting. I think not being able to see the body language probably helps us to have a lot of different possible interpretations, which I like. I like these things being really open-ended. And as soon as, you know, if you add in the body language, if you were to make a video, I think you'd be reducing it somewhat. It's an interesting question. Thank you. Was there anyone else? Yes, Bill.
So Ted, in the two books that you were talking from, are mm-hmm. they translations by Sekiba and Aiken?
Yes, they are.
Okay, so they did their own translation of the original under...
They did. Okay. They did. And you can see that their view in influencer translation, because Sekiba says scheme while Aitken says intention, and those things are really quite different. And I suppose an interesting thing for me to have done would have been to, you know, go back to the original Chinese. I don't speak Chinese, but I could get some help with that and find out are these guys kind of stretching it a little to fit their own? Are there other interpretations based on the original Chinese? Yeah. Yeah. Jeff.
Thank you so much for your talk.
Sure.
At the point where you were unpacking the story and you came to Wuman's question, at what point did Seiza drink the wine?
Mm-hmm.
You picked up your cup and you took a sip of wine.
Oh, did I?
And that moment is this moment.
And I guess that was done by absence of Ted, because I don't remember that. Thank you, Jeffrey. All right, Benton.
We have several copies of these coins in the library by translators.
By other translators.
Yeah, you could compare them all.
I could. Yeah. Well, that would be interesting. So let's all head to the library after tea. All right. Pamela.
Well, I loved your, the two different interpretations, and then your explanation of Zen today. And, I do think that, this ancient Zen, their culture and the male, monastic quality of this, they both interpretations were very combative. And, my experience with you as Zen teacher, you would say, so Pamela, what does destitute mean to you? empty or needy, or are these tears from, filling up with beauty, or are they asking me for something? You would ask me.
Yeah, I really can't imagine. Pamela, yes, sir.
You did the wrong thing. Already have 3 cups of wine.
Yeah. So we have different styles, but yeah. But these are different ways of getting at the message. And as you know, I really prefer a gentler style myself. But it's good that we have all kinds of teachers too.
But do you think that we are evolving?
I think we are evolving to it
because the two men and the story and the two men are so combative.
Oh, I think
they don't
we are
seem very compassionate.
That's right. I think we really are evolving, and I don't know the fact that these things happened in all male monasteries. It probably encouraged that kind of combative behavior, and I think, thank goodness men and women practice together now, and I do think the practice is a lot gentler, And we have that stick. It's part of our tradition that people use. If you're sitting and you request it, the teacher will give you a little whack on the shoulders, which can wake you up. And it can, I've experienced it. It's kind of nice. But we don't use that here just because I don't like the image of the teacher hitting the student with a stick. I just think there's no place for that in Zen, even if it is to, even if they do request it, and even if it does help them to wake up. No, I think we are evolving in a really gentler direction, and I think that's really good. Yes?
It makes me think about my 4-year-old Montessori. Whenever they need someone's attention, it's a hand on the shoulder.
Ah.
Right. A gentle request.
Right, Right.
I also have a question in terms of, and maybe I missed it, 3 cups of wine. Is there?
Why 3 cups? Oh, I don't know. Does anybody have an idea? I didn't think about that.
It's a standard number in Zen. It's 3.
Yeah, we tend to do things in threes.
The Trinity. Yeah.
Yeah.
The 3.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, I guess it just, it emphasizes, you know, you really have something wonderful here. You didn't just have 1 cup, you had 3. So 3 is enough to feel really good without getting really, really stupid. So, well, let's not go there. Could be. It could be actually a direct reference to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Could be.
Yeah.
Neither author commented on that.
No, they didn't. No, but there's the library downstairs. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. This has really been fun. And let's turn this over to Peter for some announcements.